Good evening, everybody. It's Wednesday. We're working our way through Life in the Labyrinth by E.J. Gold. Tonight, we're going to continue our pursuit of understanding of Chapter 5. We took these chapters, they're not lengthy as such, but they're very deep. And as we talked about earlier, they're deep because we're talking about a new planet that we're walking into. We're really walking into and practicing and understanding something about moving in the Bardos. That's not a normal human biological thing to do, Ivan.
Sounds right.
It sounds right. So this chapter is chapter 5 of Life in the Labyrinth, and as everybody knows, called Neural Network Projections. And I want to rewind a little bit. And Silverdale, maybe you can help me here, because there's some things that I think we need to look at the beginning of the chapter. Beginning of the chapter begins to tell us that in many ways the neural patterning that is there tends to continue more or less on its own. That's the same thing as the mechanicality of the machine. But at the very first page, I'm going to go back to the first page, second paragraph. And that paragraph says, the brain can be viewed as a veritable ocean of probability and a sea of uncertainty. And from this view, I wanted to underline that phrase, from this view, the probability is that any neural pathway is as likely as any other. Okay? That's important to understand. That's what's possible for us. What is actual for us is that we are stuck in a form of patterning that later on E.J. will call the headset.
So, David, are you saying that where any neural pathway is as likely as any other is without habit or without conditioning?
The nature of the electrical system in the brain doesn't necessarily of itself imply particular pathways. I know that it does in generalized areas, like sight is in one area.
Yeah.
But we also were learned from Pianja last week that if there's a brain injury, that function just moves to a different physical part of the brain. So there's something in the mechanism of the brain that where it's not necessary that a particular formulation follow in a particular place. So the probability is that its potentiality could be different. And then I'm on page 36, second paragraph, and I wanted to point out that. And it says, because it has form, I didn't read the whole paragraph, then it tends to favor one pathway over another. Okay, all I'm doing here is reemphasizing what is meant by headset. All right? And then at the bottom of that page is where he introduces the concept or the terminology, headset. Now, and then we go to page 37, and in the middle of that first full paragraph, in this sense, as we voyage through the labyrinth, it is not so much that we experience dimensional transition, it is more accurate to say that we actually remain in the same location in view of the fact that dimensions are all contained in the same space and that we experience a change in the headset. Does this make sense, first of all, that first part? Do we have questions about that? This is a very important chapter. it's important for us to have a sense of how this chapter operates. So it's maybe not that critical to understand this phrase here, the dimensions are all contained in the same space. But here's my read on it, and you know, give me some feedback too. My read is that we will always be in the same space if we are always subject to our same headset. We're in the same space. The scenery may change, but the neural programming is the same. Nothing is different there. That's, in a certain way, a different way of looking at what is called mechanicality. We carry our mechanicality around with us.
Okay, that I clearly understand, but it seems to me that the passage that you're emphasizing here, what it brings to mind is it has to do with like upscaling and downscaling,
yeah.
And you know, the idea of traveling through these dimensions. But he's saying something, you know, somebody who's more of a mathematician than I am could summon up the formulas for that. You're not materially traveling. You're not physically traveling to change dimensions.
We don't have to go to the Grand Canyon to see the Grand Canyon.
Yeah, maybe. Yeah, I'm not sure how that part of it scans, but.
And I don't mean the actual Grand Canyon. If you go to the Grand Canyon and you pull up to the Grand Canyon and you look over the rim of the canyon, it's magnificent. You're swept away by how magnificent and stunning the view is. We can have the same sense of stunningness right here.
Yeah, as a reflection of the neural. Of the neural,
if we can change
phenomenon.
Our headset.
Yeah.
Okay. Now the next phrase is super critical, in my opinion. And I would like to spend a few minutes on it. View the fact that dimensions are all contained in the same space and that we experience a change in headset in the amount of perception we are able to perceive and process. Now, so what's implied there is that there's more happening than we can see given the constraints of our particular headset. Does this make sense, Silverdale?
Yeah, it sure does. As this whole chapter points out, by the way, I'm speaking strictly from a theoretical understanding of all this. My understanding is that our historical personality is designed specifically to deal with multiplicity and diversity and is entirely conditioned by our living life sequentially. But the essential self, which is undeveloped in all of us, is at the other end of the spectrum. It perceives everything as one simple, reasonable, unified whole.
Correct.
And in this sense, it's quite capable of upscaling and downscaling because everything is unified, and it's not perceiving multiplicity and diversity. It's only perceiving variations in sets of data, I suppose, something like that. And I know that what has always frustrated me in reading this Life in the Labyrinth is that I can see that in my mind's eye. I just haven't personally experienced it in a way that lets me speak confidently about it, no matter how confident I might sound right now.
Well, you have undoubtedly experienced some of it. You see, you just identified in
Good.
A sense, you know, this exact thing. It's like, you said this is the thing, variations, and it's what a great deal of this book is about, is just what you were just saying, is variations in what? what are the variations that the essential self experiences if there's travel going on, if it's not...
And by the way, Ivan, if I can just say, all of this is actually a seamless extension of Gurdjieff's ideas, in which Gurdjieff is attempting to explain to us how we are triune beings. And in making that point, Gurdjieff says, well, look at these three forces that allow us to be a triune being develop at different times and stop developing at certain times. So the first force that develops in us is the ability to develop, is to comprehend multiplicity and diversity. We should then be able to actively develop the second force, which is our essential self, which perceives everything as a complete unity without differentiation. And then the third force is nothing more than our ability to blend those two ends of the spectrum together for ourselves, and that creates beingness. And, you know, I've just read, again, Reality of Being for the sixth time, and that's basically what that book talks about.
I have an example of this. It was many years ago, and this is when EJ was giving talks in the atrium, and we had it set up in a particular way, and I even remember what that is with the jewelry benches and like that sort of thing. I was off to the side on the, because I was running the cameras and the videoing of it. And he was, and I believe it was a talk on incense and scent.
Fragrance.
Scent. And it was a long talk, and all I can say, as the talk, I'll just say as the talk progressed, the space got all hotter and hotter. And it was as if, because there was more and more intensity in that space. As that occurred, I'm talking about probably about a four-hour session here. As that occurred, certain people would fall asleep. And he'd continue, and all I can say is that it felt as if the energy in the space was spiraling upward. It was almost as if the content of the tape, of the talk, was less important than the sensation we were getting from being in that space. I believe that as that was occurring, as we develop more capacity for perception, we have the ability to hang out in this space that I call, in this space that I call the space of cleansing radiation. And this is a very important point for me. Okay, go ahead.
Yeah, before I forget, things go fleetingly through the mental apparatus, as Silverdale would say. That to me, what you're describing is, I believe that is an example of dimensional travel.
Correct.
That he is talking about here, which is to say that everybody was going through a voyage. You know, they were going through changes together. There was movement happening, but it wasn't from space to space.
No.
This is exactly what it was, is that the multiplicity, what were you saying, George? The artifacts, the objects, or let's say the visual perception of that space, or what it looked like, maybe even what it smelled like, what it felt like in terms of temperature and all that kind of thing, were within a certain range, were fairly pretty much the same, but there was something that was changing very radically. there was an element. There was a way in which there was travel happening. So.
But I'm also pointing out this concept of capacity. Because some people, I don't know what it means, weren't meant to be there. They left. The way they left is they just nodded off into La La Land.
Yeah, you become this they were in the same space where all of these dimensions were, but they became unconscious.
They weren't in the dimension.
They weren't in the dimension. They were still in the space.
They were still
my body is still in the space, but guess what? I passed out. There was a dimensional change, and I didn't go along with that dimensional change. Right? So I've often fallen asleep and talked about that.
So it's Susan here. I have a comment.
Susan, greetings.
Hello. I take this really, I've had an experience of driving in the car, and I'm in one just mind place, and then I pop into reality, and then I can see the difference in the texture of the trees and the colors.
Yes.
And you can see so much more, and then depending on how much you can let in is what you can see.
Okay. So repeat that exact same term again.
Well, I was, recalling driving and being just driving in the street, asleep. And then I popped into awareness, and then I could see the difference in the texture and the color and the greenness of the trees, and it became alive, and it was just like 1 second later, and I hadn't, physically, of course, gone anywhere.
And the term you used is, the more I let in.
Whatever I can perceive during that state of being.
Yes. The more I let in. At that moment, there was a principle of volition occurring. We're going to see this later at the end of the chapter, where it says that the greatest threat to the human biological machine is the evolutionary process of the essential self.
Sure.
So the more you can let in, is Lupe on the chat at all? You see? No? She'll understand this. And there are, Aria will know, but, okay, good. So say some comments so I can repeat it to the tape.
Comment.
Yeah. Tiandra says that the more our being grows, the more we are aware that there is more out there than we can see. Dean makes us aware of more. Critical, underline that. I'll post the log and underline that phrase. More Dean capacity, as Susan says, the more I allow in, the amount of. Go ahead. Our being allows us to expand our
perceptions.
Yeah.
The Don Juan tradition.
We're going to get to that in two more pages.
Change in the location of the assemblage point?
Yes. Yeah, exactly, Simon. And we're going to, I made that comment, but later on in about two more pages.
Yeah, and let me just add one more thing. Before we leave this example of David's, there's another one. There's actually a wonderful example from a talk, which is actually captured in a talk of the month, and I wish I could remember the name of it. I'll look it up. Maybe somebody out there can remember. At the dinner table when Claire was still alive. It was near the end of her life. She had cancer, and she knew. Anyway, she knew she was terminal, and she had questions for EJ. And there was this incredible passage in the talk there where EJ wished to answer her a question in regard to the clear light, and he just, and something happened in the room, the light changed, the atmosphere changed in the dining room, and basically EJ said to Claire, okay, do you see that? Do you see this now? Look around. And Claire looked around, and so did everybody else, and EJ said, so do you see this is the, that's the clear light, this is the clear light, this is what it looks like. And then he said something like, so, and you, Claire, you don't have, you have nothing to worry about in regard to this because you're ready for this. You're ready to enter into this clear light. But it was a, it may not be so obvious from the printed talk, you know, this is what David was saying,
yes.
The content, in the words and the content of the printed talk, it may not be entirely clear that that space changed. This wasn't a gradual change over hours. That space changed immediately. There was a moment that when EJ literally invoked the clear light, and
those that has eyes.
Yeah. Well, everybody experienced something from that. I definitely recall how different that, you know, how refined, you know, basically how changed the room became, even though, you know, it was nothing like a hallucination,
right,
or a dream or anything else, immaterial, let's say, or whatever. It, you know, it was the same room, it was the same people, but the light changed, the atmosphere changed. There was, you know, there were these subtleties that he talks about in some, that we'll get to in some later chapters here, and he basically was pointing to that and pointing it out to Claire. He was producing that dimensional experience for her.
So we have a couple of concepts running here. Concept of the headset, the concept of capacity,
mm-hmm.
and now this emanation thing is happening. So how much do we allow in? And so now I'm going to jump ahead a couple of pages. I'm on page 39. That's about where we left off last time. Somewhere around there.
If you give me the beginning of the paragraph, I can find you because this is different imagination.
Okay, I'm on page 40 of the new edition, and that the paragraph I want to start is on the other hand. So that's
Got it.
Okay. On the other hand, when the machine is technically in the waking state, the head brain, which would normally generate continuously updated holographic representation, is automatically disabled, functioning in this state as a motor center, which produces the effect of freeing our vision from its normal constraints. Our perception of the surrounding world no longer depends upon the head brain's holographic hallucinations, and we suddenly discover that because we are able to use our own fairly unlimited attention and are no longer limited to the extremely finite number of attention units of the machine, we can see a veritable wealth of detail we never noticed before. Now,
very similar to what's
not, isn't it? It's very similar.
Yeah.
This is a mouthful. This is the key to it. So when we're in the waking state, we're in the position to begin this process. And Silverdale, in the human biological machine, it says it's the human biological machine as a transformational apparatus. And there's an interplay that we, quite beautiful in the HPM, where it talks about where the, when the machine is awakened and the essential self starts to come back to the machine. And there's a vibratory interplay between the two. Okay, when it's in the waking state. So if this is something that makes sense to you, make a comment about it. Say something that might be helpful to others. We're at the very beginning of this now. So when it's in the waking state and the essential self is up, that's when we're at the beginning of Bardo traveling. That's when it's possible. Mm-hmm. Prior to that, it's not possible. You're in just linearity.
Right.
Now, so does this seem true to you? I know there's several people. There's somebody who has struggled with capacity over the years and who I've had a few phone calls this week, and this individual, realized that they were into capacity issues. And then, but they reached out in a different way, and then they could see more. That's the opportunity we have here, is once we're in that space and the capacity, we recognize points of capacitance, okay, where we have a point where we can't, we're at our capacity.
Right.
That's when it's time to, now, what do? Do you like push on real hard? It's actually the opposite. You surrender. You surrender. You have an inward surrender to that next space. It's very difficult for the machine to do that because the machine does understand it is under siege.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? Next paragraph. The real world begins to dawn upon us in the waking state, in the expansion. The environment, including the human biological machine, which is very much a part of the environment, becomes transparent and luminescent, a dew glistened gossamer web. Simon, does that sound like Don Juan, or does that sound like Don Juan? A luminous being is what Don Juan talks about.
Well, this is... I love the way this is. I hadn't even noticed in this chapter before how it's gone from all of this, neuroscience.
Correct.
And almost mathematics. And this is like this little paragraph there and this discussion now of becoming a voyager. This is going directly into mysticism. These are the sort of language similar to those attempts to describe mystical experience.
The Christian mystics, particularly in the golden age of the Christian mystics, there were some great writers, and they would, your senses were flipped. They would see sounds and they would hear colors.
Mm-hmm.
It didn't matter to them.
Right.
They weren't constrained by their headset.
They read in Blake, too. William Blake, he wrote some poems that are just so totally out of the historical time. It must not have made much sense to people at the time.
As we approach our new life, the life of the voyager, the life of the human biological machine, an illusion of light below the infinite, a residual effect of stillness and silence seems to disappear, leaving the voyager free to explore the labyrinth. This is the precipice that we're at. And we've carried all of ourselves along. We are all right here with that, all of us. And I can see that there's individuals who are right on the edge of that. They're right on the edge of being in this new space. They're right on the edge of allowing themselves to live in the life of the voyager, so that they will become voyagers, not human biological machines trying to figure this stuff out. You can't. The secret keeps itself. why does the secret keep itself? Because we're not allowing it to come in. And Susan's phrase was so poignant, so powerful. What do I allow in? And do you allow yourself? Do you allow yourself to go to that level and allow more in and more in and more in? Okay?
Hey, David, I'd like to just share one paragraph from the book, Reality of Being, that addresses the same idea, just in different words.
Thank you, George.
So this is the book, Reality of Being, by Jean de Saltzman. She says, we wish to be conscious of the inner presence as a second body in us that must live its own life. It needs to have an action on our physical body and not be demolished as the body also lives its own life. For the moment, what is important is to let this energy grow in us to take on force. We must feel that it needs a connection with a higher energy. The question is how to allow this new body to develop, how to absorb subtle vibrations until they saturate my presence. And so really, this is the description of how the essential self grows and develops.
So this is precisely what the second half of this chapter is about. We now know that we emerge in a lifestyle, in a sense, with this headset, this mechanicality. And yet, when we venture into the world of the essential self, we're in a different vibratory space. And what was the term they used? Avail ourselves of...
higher energy.
Higher energy source. And read the last part, the last couple of sentences again, please.
We must feel that it needs a connection with a higher energy. The question is how to allow this new body to develop, how to absorb subtle vibrations until they saturate my presence.
Okay, that's the point.
Saturate my presence. Yeah.
Subtle vibrations.
Yeah.
What are those subtle vibrations? Those subtle vibrations are happening right now. Right now. Our job is to allow them to steep in the stew that we're growing here. We're not advanced such that we know how to connect up exactly with the higher dimensions and all this stuff. That's there. We're not quite there. We're just at the point of that last phraseology of subtle vibrations permeating. How do we do that? The more time we spend in this space that we are in right now, the more time we spend in this space, it backwashes and affects the nature of the way that the headset works. And it opens new pathways. By being in this space right now, we are experiencing cleansing radiation. In experiencing those, it is you're 1 inch closer to the saturation of the essential self. And if you have the faith in yourself that you should have by the very nature of the way we are constructed, then even a moment that you can spend there is more important, is very important. Stretch when you're in that space. When you're in this space right now, surrender to the extent you can to the vibratory sensations that you feel. Just try to relax. Try to surrender right now. Just see what it feels like to surrender for this space. When you do that, you'll notice that there's more there. You'll notice that there's more there. And the subtle vibrations permeate one more second of the essential self's life. Very good. Thank you so much for that reading. As the machine awakens, the will of the machine is annihilated, producing a transference of will and action from the machine to the Voyager. Now we've become Voyagers. This is the very first of a long series of transformations which enable us to work in the macro dimensions. I mean, this subtlety of work and the method of doing this kind of work doesn't end in our lifetime. It's something we'll practice all the time. Even if you entered into, let's say you were a chess player, and let's say you were really good and you actually got rated in the country, and let's say you were like level, 13,429. You have a long way to go, don't you? We're in the same boat. We're in the game, and we have a long way to go. And it's that vibratory sensation, these subtle vibrations that we get. What's another place that we get them? Where does this kind of voyaging remind you? What's another thing that, does it remind you of anything? Anybody? Simon says beachhead. That's a good idea. He's talking about the beach, establishing a beachhead and that practice that we have of awakening the machine in the mornings. What happens at night? Yanja says it reminds him of prayer. Swimming through what?
Waves.
Becky says, swimming through waves. Yes. So, dreaming, if we can allow ourselves to be in the dream space, and we work in the world of intentional dreaming to the extent that we're able to, doesn't mean you need to be able to remember your dreams and write them down. That in part is the mechanicality of the machine. But it's while you're dreaming, if you can sense the fact that you're dreaming, and that's a way of being in the voyaging world, but attempt to invoke while you're there in the dream space and work in the world of intentional dreaming. That's putting more time into this particular kind of effort. Praying, when you can start it out artificially if that's all you can do. Let's say that you decide you're going to read for somebody. By that I mean working with the American Book of the Dead by E.J. Gold also, and working, reading the chambers. Just go read the chambers. Just start reading through the chambers. It will put you in a different space. Embrace that space and sense the subtle vibrations of those spaces. Okay? And for some people, it's not that subtle. Some people realign themselves actually by doing readings, right? Okay, the environment is infinitely more complex than anything the brain can project. The brain is limited to a number a certain number of symbolic references, if we understand. It has only so much memory, capacity, and simulations to work with, and it can't be expected to yield any greater detail in its simulations than the available number of units of attention will allow. The finite numbers of simulations afford a finite amount of detail. We can demonstrate this to ourselves. Here you go, campers. We can demonstrate that by focusing our attention on one item, observing the amount of detail formerly perceived in the environment as a whole set now transferred to the single item, enabling it to be perceived in greater detail. Did anybody hear my babbling about the microphone?
Yes, I did.
So right now, everybody that's online or that's here, there's an object nearby. Just for the moment, turn your attention, select an object. I'd actually wouldn't I like it if people online would say, I'm going to look at this object, like declare it in a sense. So I might say I'm going to look at this little glass case here. Yeah, very good. Okay. Good. Excellent. Okay, so now look at those objects. Keep looking at it for just another minute. Notice something about it. Okay, that. Now notice one more thing. What's its temperature? What color is it? Does it seem to move just a little bit when you look at it carefully? Keep looking at it. Keep looking at it. Look at the other side of it. Turn your head slightly and just look at it in a different way. What we're doing in that moment, then, is we're increasing the capacity of the brain to see these things. I used to sell the art, and I used to sell jewelry. And it's a fascinating experience to describe a piece, a necklace, to somebody. I actually have a necklace that I'm thinking about for somebody. And so, and you describe it in detail. And suddenly, the person's attention, which was just cursory at first, suddenly is focused on something. And often at that time, they may see that necklace as a portal. Because what you're doing now in focusing on your coffee cup or the lamp or the desk is it's starting to create a portal for you to begin the voyaging process. That object will never be the same for you again. The next time you notice that cup, the lamp, the desk, the pencil, the book, it'll have a little different sheen to it. That's the sheen that lets you know that it's a portal and available to you. We may have obtained a few less occluded glimpses now and then as the organic perceptions were short-circuited by various traumatizations. During these experiences, we undoubtedly grasp the fact that ordinarily we are unable to perceive anything approaching the amount of detail actually existing. And our ordinary machine state of vertical sleep, we are even further from any exact perception of our true surroundings. We have a sense of that then. When we look at these objects in detail, how much we're missing. And the feeling of frustration when we first saw and understood the stunning severity of the limitations of the biological perceptual apparatus, must have left a wake of outrage at nature as we came to realize to what extent our perceptions are blunted. Check out, for instance, how did it come about that the, let's just take, for instance, the Native American tribes, that they knew certain plants were medicinal. Did they pick the plants, just systematically go test them in the labs?
Not likely.
Oh, wait, they didn't have labs.
I don't think so.
So how is it that they were able to pick medicinal plants consistently and accurately over the years? Number of people are saying trial and error.
No, they did.
I don't think it was by trial and error. I think it was because they were able to be in this vibratory world where they could see things directly, and they could see that the vibratory principle of a particular plant.
That's true too. But that's subtle.
That's what we're talking about. They actually physically explored the world, Molly is saying.
Well, and they could talk to the plants.
There was an intercourse of conversation with these plants. Exactly right. Because they surrendered their own ego sensitivity to interface with the vibratory sensation of these powerful plants around them. And that, Simon, also reminds us of the great conversations that Von Juan had with Carlos about, you know, the little smoke.
And by the way, Dave, I'll remind you that Don Juan mentioned that what he had was the product of a lineage that was a couple of thousand years old, so they had been accumulating that centrality for their existence, that indigenous centrality over many generations.
Many generations. And, for instance, there's, you know, if you read the Don Juan stuff, there, Castaneda describes how when Don Juan is picking something, how careful he is to do it. I have to treat it just right. Because he is in the world of direct perception. So we know it exists. Where we are now in Chapter 5 of Life in the Labyrinth is we can also begin that journey of opening up those perceptual abilities. This is not fantasy. This is not a good story that was really cool to read. We're saying you can do it directly.
Well, it's like Findhorn.
Yeah. These are all examples of people that spent time doing it. We have the ability to do it right now, and we are doing it, but we have to practice. Every time, I'm just like a broken record, I keep bringing that up. But now the practice is staying in the space in which you are a voyager. And there's been a few conversations this week. Stay in the space where you are a voyager. And it's a dangerous space, but it's dangerous from the point of view of the machine only. But it's the world, in a sense, the world of salvation. As our old friend Spinoza says, all things excellent are as difficult as they are rare. And we are at that moment of rarity. Where are we, Ivan?
Well,
glimpses of the real world without the limitations of perceptual organs of the human biological machine reveal several interesting observations. The real world only vaguely resembles what we have taken to be the world all along. vaguely, indeed. And not only is the real world far more complex and more detailed than we have taken it to be, but evidently the brain, without consulting us, in its enthusiasm to compress incoming impressions into manageable mass matching, has created severe limitations. That's funny. That's very funny.
Imagine a severe limited simulation.
Yeah. So the machine has extremely limited capacity. It's just trying to help. Trying to catalog the infinitude of what's about us into something that's manageable. And then jumping ahead to the top of page 43, and this is that under that set of priorities, see that paragraph item,
yeah.
Many environmental items do not have very high priority. The greatest threat to the machine survival is, of course, the process of transformation and voluntary evolution represented by the macro dimensions, portrayed by the brain as nothingness, clearly marking it to be ignored and forgotten about, which in most cases takes care of any impossible natural curiosity. We seek to be curious. Look at the shadows. Look at between things. Look between the shadows. What's there? Follow a slightly different path when you're walking to your desk at work. Sit down in a different manner. Use a different hand to turn a light on. As long as we restrict ourselves to interactions with our own brain simulation of the environment, we can only conceive of the labyrinth as a series of subjective phenomena, of course, generated within the brain and suggested by the environment, leaving us for all practical purposes in the dark about the real world. If we insist on remaining dependent upon those bad guesses, we run the risk of making some very grave mistakes. We can correlate these interiorized simulations and relegate them to different functionings of the brain, recognizing that one or the other brain function has become passive, active, or inactive, and therefore seems to propel us into a different part. Suppose for the moment that we have bypassed the organic perceptics and we are for once able to see the real world as it is. Now we see that we have been only a hair's breadth away from it all our lives. We had the eyes, but we did not see, and we had the ears, but did not hear.
Mm-hmm.
Now, we can see, feel, touch, and sense, and oh, how we can sense. And he brings us right back to that state.
Oh. Yeah, the expanded sense.
So our job is to pick up the hints that are around you. Pick up the hints that are around you all the time and know where and what chamber to go in when those hints are about you. If that hint is there, act on it. That's the bravery that comes about. Why is it brave? Because it's a challenge to the human biological machines. Bullshit, okay? The human biological machine has taken the magnificence of this poetic adventure that we're in and has said, here is the linearity of it.
Mm-hmm. Daytime television.
The world has become daytime television.
So
and in fact, it is so much more than that. It is imbued with meaning and imbued with purpose. We have to loose from our eyes the darkness and open our ears so that we can hear. And when we do that, you'll find the clues be about you each day. Each day you'll find them. And you'll find specific things to do. And sometimes all you can do is surrender in the moment. Try that one. How are we doing? Okay. Thank you.
Any more comments to read? Or? Well, we'll probably you just have to read the law. Coming from plants.
Yeah, they
listen.
Yeah, so Becky says that if you ignore something, it will bite you sooner or later. If you ignore something that you're supposed to work with, it'll keep coming back and remind you of your work. Because it is there. Okay, thank you. Yeah. So, this is not just good literature to read and be inspired by. This actually, this chapter is a key chapter to how to begin living more of your life as a voyager.
Right. The voyager language.
The voyager language
voyager
is there. The voyager world is there every day. Like, for instance, I know something exactly that I'm going to do on Friday. That's theoretical. But when I get there to do it, it's going to burst alive with probability. And it's kind of managing that probability to see which particular path I will walk down at that moment. Okay? Yeah, Ivan, why don't you go ahead?
That leads into, that's a good lead-in for this.
The end.
Quatrain here. More stumbling than trying increases the likelihood of finding. To try is to fail. To do is to succeed.
So any one of these do, challenge yourself to open up and surrender to more to this space. You'll make bumps in the road, but continue and nevertheless. Next week, we are going to take a week off. We will not be here next week. We're going to continue the week after that. Next weekend is the Easter, not this coming weekend, but the following weekend, which is the
April
7th?
6th and
7th. 6th, 7th, and 8th is a Easter workshop. There's a number of people coming, and it's also going to be online. And you can find out more about that at idhhb.com.
Yeah, that's the Ishtar
and
celebration, I believe.
So the next week, next Wednesday, no class. The following Wednesday, which I believe is the 11th, there will be a class. So there will not be a class next week, and the following Wednesday there will be a class. And we will be working on Chapter 6, The Illusion of Time. As the chapters progress, we're going to get more and more and more into the Voyager world. It's not going to be super comfortable. I know. So, thank you for coming this
David,
evening.
Are you just skipping a class because this chapter is called The Illusion of Time?
Thank you for coming. I look forward to seeing you sometime in the future. Good night.
Good night, all.